I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Even though the Affordable Care Act became law more than 3 years ago, it has not fully taken effect. It's not easy changing a complicated multi-trillion dollar part of the U.S. economy. The Obama administration announced last week that it would delay the employer provision of the health care plan for a year, which gave critics ammunition to use against the plan. The president touted the benefits of Obamacare at an event at the White House last week and pointed to a new report showing a drop in premiums in a number of states. Meanwhile, states and DHS are scrambling to meet the October deadline for implementing online health insurance exchanges for the individual mandate. Confused? Well, you're not alone. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Robert Towne is an associate professor of healthcare management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute for Health Economics at the University of Pennsylvania. Also a research associate at the National Bureau for, or I should say, of Economic Research. And Bob Towne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us, David Grandy. He's a physician, assistant professor at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics at the University of Pennsylvania. And David Grandy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
What do you think the significance of this delay of the employer mandate means?
Well, I think a lot has been made of it in the press. But on the other hand, its real world implications for its impact on coverage, I think, will be almost zero. The most important parts of the Affordable Care Act will continue to get implemented as of January 1, as they were intended to. The fact that the employer mandate won't be a part of that for the first year will actually have almost no impact on the number of people covered.
But why do you think the administration, Bob, though, what were they responding to by delaying this?
Well, regulations were very complicated to implement. They defined full-time as 30 hours per week, but many people don't work on an hourly basis. They work on a commission basis or some other kind of incentive basis. So deciding who is full-time and who is not turned out to be a much more complicated task than they envisioned. And this was an easy solution to, wait for a year and see if we can reformulate the legislation in order to have a more sensible implementation.
Is that what they're going to do for the next year then, which is to revisit some of these provisions?
I think they're going to revisit the regulations. I think they would like to revisit the legislation in this regard, but that might be difficult given the current issues in the Congress.
I was reading something from Kaiser Health News, and they talked about a guy that has a restaurant in Pittsburgh, and a quote here, "It's nothing but a noose hanging over my head. I've got to come up with $50,000 a year to pay health care costs. That is literally taking 75 to 80% of the small profit that I've been able to generate in the last few years." Do you think he speaks for a lot of smaller? And we realize this is for people with 50 employees and more.
There's no doubt that for employers who are over 50 employees who don't currently provide health insurance, which is a very small minority, 96% of firms over 50 employees offer health insurance already, and they won't be affected by this regulation. But for those firms that currently don't offer health insurance for their employees, there's no doubt that it can be a burden.
What do you think? I mean, do you think this can be fixed?
Yeah, I think that it's important to keep your eyes on the big picture here. So, we have the experience of Massachusetts of a combination of an employer mandate and an individual mandate. In Massachusetts, the penalties for employers if they did not offer insurance were very modest. And again, in the Affordable Care Act, the penalties that we see are relatively modest. And what we actually saw in Massachusetts was that employers were more likely to offer coverage even with a very modest penalty. I think the combination of the individual mandate and the employer mandate just increases a sense by consumers out there that having health insurance is important, and that when you go to seek out a job, that you should be looking for getting health insurance there. And so I think it surprised people in Massachusetts to see the rates of employer-sponsored insurance go up.
To go up?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's interesting. But this act, or at least delay, seems to have given critics of the healthcare plan a lot of ammunition to say, oh, the whole thing doesn't work. And, of course, we saw the House last week voting once again to repeal key portions
sure.
of the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, I think this is a very complex law to implement. And I think it was very predictable along the way that there would be a lot of these moments through implementation where the administration would have to revisit some of the issues. And it's a very polarized political environment. And so it's not surprising that, you know, the opposition would seize on those moments. And, you know, sometimes those are legitimate criticisms, and other times I think they're very much overblown. You know, in this instance, I think it is overblown.
But does it make sense to hold on to the sort of employer-based part of this health care plan? Does that make sense to you?
Well, broadly, you know, economists have long criticized the employer-based health insurance structure that we currently have. It's inefficient in a lot of ways because it ties health insurance to employment, which has a lot of undesirable consequences. But the focus of the ACA, at least on expanding coverage, is twofold. One is the Medicaid expansions, and two is the health insurance exchanges, enrolling people through the health insurance exchanges. And the benchmark by which I think the ACA will be judged is how many people enroll in these health insurance exchanges. Mm. Are they popular? Does it really make a dent in the uninsurance rates?
So the idea of an employer-based healthcare system, that's here to stay. We're going to talk about some of these other parts as well, but that's what we've had, and that will stay.
That will stay.
You agree?
Completely agree. You know, employer-sponsored insurance has been part of American healthcare for over a half century now. So to think that that's suddenly going to go away, regardless of what we do. You know, this is part of employees' expectations. I think when they particularly work for medium or large employers, that this is part of the benefit package. And I can't imagine that going away anytime in the near future.
So the real issue is this individual mandate, yes?
Yeah, that's the game changer. So, you know, I think that is really, and analyses show this, that is really what's going to bring people into these marketplaces or exchanges and turn them into buyers. And at the same time, you know, the government will step in and help people who are under 400% of poverty with purchasing insurance. But the individual mandate, as we saw in Massachusetts, is very effective at bringing people into the marketplace.
And do you think the rest of the United States is like Massachusetts, though?
Well, you know, there was some unique things in Massachusetts with the rollout of that law, which is very different than how the rollout is happening in all 50 states. You know, there was kind of an all-hands-on-deck approach, I think, in Massachusetts where, you know, everyone, including the Boston Red Sox, were involved in outreach. And the environment here is very different where, you know, the Republicans in some instances are actively trying to undermine implementation of the law while the administration is trying to make it work. And so that's a very different setting, I think, than what happened in Massachusetts. So, you know, I think that depending what state people live in, rollout could look very different.
Well, let me go back to you, Bob. And we're talking about 50 million people that are uninsured at this point?
Yeah, that's correct.
And the idea is if you get everyone insured, you can spread the cost, I guess, spread the risk, and thereby control some of the costs? Is that the sort of bottom line thinking here?
Well, I think the bottom line thinking is that there's certainly some aspect of getting everybody insured, which will provide, you know, better incentives for them to use care, so they stay out of the ER and things like that. But I think the primary goal here is to provide coverage, because coverage is beneficial in and of itself.
Because you have coverage.
Because you have coverage. You can access health care at, you know, at a reduced out-of-pocket cost.
So how do you get 50 million people to sign up for health insurance when clearly some can't afford it and some don't think they need it and some don't want it?
So you're not going to get 50 million people to sign up. I think the administration would be very happy if half of those people were able to find insurance through the ACA. Mm-hmm. So how do you do it? You provide subsidies for premiums and you expand Medicaid. That is the principal mechanism. And then you overlay the individual mandate. That's the key kind of three legs of this.
Go ahead. Yeah, David, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I think it's important to keep in mind that too often we focus on, you know, very narrow aspects of health insurance and its impact on how people utilize care. But insurance at its heart is meant to protect people financially when they get sick. That, you know, we buy life insurance for that very reason, to provide economic protection for our families. And so, you know, health insurance plays that role to provide some economic security. And even if, you know, only half of people who are uninsured sign up today, what will be very different in the future is if people do get sick, even if they're uninsured, they will have an entry point into our health insurance system that they don't currently have. right now, you know, if patients have pre-existing conditions and, you know, they don't have a source of stable coverage from an employer and they pick up the phone to try to call a health insurance company to get insurance for themselves, they're either likely to be turned down or charged a very high premium that they can't afford. And so in that respect, you know, even if we only get halfway there on getting people covered, it's a game changer in terms of people's ability to access the insurance system.
But would it be fair to say that, I guess, the prized group in this 50 million are the quote-unquote young invincibles? These are the young, healthy people that, might not have insurance, Bob?
Yeah, that's the key to making this all work. They're going to – the young invincibles are ultimately going to be the ones who may subsidize the older invincibles. and if they don't sign up, there could be some problems. But they'll have incentives to sign up. They have these subsidies, and they'll have access to a health insurance market that will be, you know, better functioning for them.
And do we need celebrities to reach out to these people?
It would be helpful, but probably not necessary.
But these, we were talking about this before going on the air, these have been described as the people who helped to put President Obama in office and put him back in office. And I guess the question is, can you get them to then sign on to his signature accomplishment, if you can call it that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's, we don't really have a good precedent for a big law like this being rolled out. You know, we have some precedents with seniors with Medicare Part D, but, you know, this population of young adults is complicated and hard to reach, you know, and at least in a campaign fashion, they were able to reach them. How that extends to health insurance, I don't think anyone knows exactly.
Twitter? Did you want to add something to that?
Well, I think one of the important places to look on this law is Texas. Texas has the highest number of uninsured, and it's also a place that's pretty hostile to the ACA broadly. And so how the ACA rolls out in Texas will be very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Do we know that yet, or is there any evidence of how it will be rolled out and how people would respond?
Well, I think that the state of Texas has been pretty hostile to the implementation of the ACA in Texas, but there will be an exchange in Texas. There will, you know, Texans will have access to these subsidies. So we'll see.
You agree with that?
Yes. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that these are going to be the most challenging places for the administration to make the law work. On the other hand, I think that there'll be some, you know, the other side of this, there'll be some great lessons learned, because I think there's going to be some variability in the country in terms of getting people signed up, how that impacts insurance rates. And hopefully, I think once we see, and I think we will see successes in certain parts of the country, and we probably will see some challenges in other parts, that helps push this into a framework where both parties can hopefully get together and try to focus on making it work.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very sharp break. We're getting update and explainer of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Our guests are Robert Town and David Grandy, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
When Johnny Marr first heard the Smiths' classic, How Soon Is Now, the experience was, for him, like for us, magic.
I remember waking up and it was dark, and I had this cassette by the side of my bed, and I was like, what happened last night? I think I did something really amazing.
Guitar hero Johnny Marr joins us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a Chinese company won the contract to build a $40 billion canal in Nicaragua, but there's skepticism it will actually happen.
There are a lot of barriers in terms of the environmental issues, political issues. I don't plan on floating down the Nicaragua canal anytime soon, but who am I to say that it can't happen?
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about or getting an update on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and some of the challenges for health consumers, for insurers, providers, state, and the federal government. And again, our guests are Robert Towne, Associate Professor of Healthcare Management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, Senior Fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute for Health Economics at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, David Grandy, a physician, assistant professor at the Perelman School of Medicine at Penn and a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics as well. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And David, just jumping off what you said right before the break, I'm looking at New York Times, July 16th, 2013, headline, Health Plan Costs for New York is Set to Fall 50%.
Yeah, so New York is a great example to look at how this law is supposed to work. So for New York has been one of the states out there that has a lot of insurance regulations that require insurers to sell policies to people who have pre-existing conditions or are sick. So the outcome of that, of course, is that rates are very high there because you're attracting more sick consumers into insurance plans there. And so the individual mandate being brought to bear in the state of New York is going to bring a lot more healthy people into the insurance pool. So it's not surprising to see estimates out of New York that insurance premiums are expected to fall a lot because it is going to diversify the patients that are covered in these insurance pools and bring in those young, healthy adults that we were talking about.
And Bob, there I know were some other states, I think D.C. included, that not 50% drop, but seeing a drop in some of these health insurance premiums.
Yeah, premiums that have been announced appear to be about 18% lower than what was anticipated. So these exchanges seem to be working in the sense that premiums are going to be lower even than the CBO had forecasted.
Why? I mean, why this discrepancy? And it's a happy discrepancy, I should say.
I think we don't know yet, but there could be a couple of different factors. One is that the type of products that are being offered on the exchanges are a bit different than what folks are typically used to. Insurers are offering more narrow networks for providers in order to drive down costs. So there's some changes, I think, in the types of insurance that are being offered on the exchanges that are a bit different that are probably driving down the costs.
But are these states that have decided, whether they like it or not, to in a sense, embrace the Affordable Care Act and to try to make it work within their states?
Well, states that are embracing the Affordable Care Act are certainly attracting more insurers, and so there's more competition because they've attracted more insurers than states that are more hostile to it.
Well, and there are a number of states that are hostile to the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, of course, and those are the states ultimately where, you know, the responsibility falls on the administration to set up these exchanges or marketplaces there. And what Bob was pointing out, obviously, if you're a state and you're setting up your own exchange, you have the ability to work a lot more in attracting insurers into the bidding process. The administration has to put these marketplaces together for, you know, nearly half the states around the country, and in doing so just doesn't have the bandwidth, I think, to focus so much on creating very broad, expansive pools of competition. But that could develop over time, and it's important to recognize that this is how things will look in year one. A state can decide at any point to get in the game here and, you know, start to run their own exchange. The administration, I'm sure, would be happy to hand that off to them. And they can also decide at any point in time to get in the game on the Medicaid expansion as well. So it's not a one-and-done decision.
But October 1st, I guess, is the beginning of the opening of these exchanges. Is the government ready for this? Have they put a system into place?
They say they're ready. Whether they are ready, I think we'll find out on October 1st. Yeah, I think it's hard to know for sure. There's a lot of technical kind of capabilities that have to be put into place. Part of this is outreach and things like that, but a big part of this is the IT infrastructure to make these things work and to make the consumer experience, you know, a good one. And it's hard to know what that's going to look like until we actually see it.
And I guess a good experience is one, it makes sense, it's navigable, it gives you the information that you're looking for, it's digestible, all these things.
Yeah, and it tells you what type of insurance you're eligible for. That'll be a big challenge, is that separating out what types of insurance folks are eligible. Are they eligible for Medicaid? Are they eligible for these premium tax credits? or are they not eligible? And sort of sorting that out is a challenge. Mm-hmm.
But if we're talking about, and actually the last time you were on the show, David, we were talking about the fact that something like 40% of the country didn't really understand our healthcare system. And I guess the question is, if you don't understand the system, and it is complicated, I guess I'm back at you, Bob, which is then how do you navigate, you know, a system if you really don't know what it is you want, what you have, what you need, all of that?
That's important. And part of the ACA has these type of navigators, which are designed to help people select insurance, particularly if they have problems with English or not familiar with the healthcare system. The navigators are supposed to guide them to enrolling in a health insurance plan.
And, you know, and we saw this with the rollout of Medicare Part D. Everybody looks at Medicare Part D now as being a very successful law. In some ways, there's many aspects of it that are very analogous to this. It's, in essence, this, you know, setting up these exchanges for prescription drug plans for seniors. And, you know, that was a heavy lift to implement that law. And we saw probably about 3 to 6 months of some growing pains in that. And actually, the Secretary of Health and Human Services at that time wrote an op-ed, I think a couple weeks ago, in the Washington Post, talking about the growing pains of Medicare Part D and how the administration's going to have to work through those and how they need to get out on the road and start doing more outreach. So, you know, I think there are some analogous situations to Medicare Part D. Now everyone loves that law, but it was hard, you know, in the first year.
Well, I'm thinking about what the president was saying yesterday in the White House, you know, flanked by, I guess, people that are happily insured, this kind of tableau there. And he talked about some of the benefits of the healthcare plan. But it is interesting that people are still struggling to understand our own healthcare system. Does that surprise you?
Not at all. I mean, I think that people who are well insured today, if they're not sick and they haven't used their health insurance a lot, and you ask them, you know, how their benefits are structured and what would happen if they got sick and how much money they'd have to pay and which doctors they could see, I think very few people could answer those questions. I think people come to understand their insurance by utilizing the healthcare system and having that experience of what happens when I go to fill a prescription, what happens when I go to my primary care doctor, how much did it cost, what happened when I went to see a specialist, you know, could I get an appointment, how much did it cost? And people only understand their insurance after they start using it.
Do you think, though, that the Obama administration could do a better job of either promoting this or explaining this plan?
Well, it's clear that people don't understand the plan, so there seems to be a gap there. I think the administration's in a little bit of a tough spot because this has become such a touchstone that talking about the ACA tends to get people's hair a little on end or bore them. You know, you're caught between two difficult spots. But it's clear that the marketing of the ACA has not been a priority.
And it is interesting that people generally criticize the plan, but when you talk to them about some of the individual provisions of the plan, they say, oh, yeah, I like that.
Yeah. There are many aspects of the ACA that's going to be beneficial to a lot of people. And so, you know, there's for most people, they're going to gain something or be unaffected by the law.
And I've thought, as someone who just sort of has, you know, annual go to the doctor checkups, things like that, and I've noticed that I don't necessarily get charged for everything. It would be nice if someone could give me a note saying, you know, brought to you by the Affordable Care Act, just so people can understand how they do interact with the system.
And I think the administration would love to see those messages attached to the benefits of the Affordable Care Act. The reality is, I think it's hard to connect those two things. One thing I read that I think will be interesting is when the administration sets up these marketplaces in states that have decided not to expand their Medicaid program, they're going to have to send some message to the person on the other end about why they're not eligible and how they're going to communicate that and what the ramifications are for whether people start to push their own governors, I think, to implement some aspects of this law when they see in black and white in front of them what the implications are of not expanding their Medicaid program, for example.
Or looking at New York and seeing people's – I'm assuming they were probably expensive to begin with, but seeing states where premiums have been reduced and maybe even less than theirs.
Yeah, of course.
Well, that's David Grandy, again, a physician assistant professor at the Perelman School of Medicine at Penn, a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics, also at Penn, and Robert Towne with us as well, associate professor of healthcare management at the Wharton School, senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics, and both of them joining us today in Radio Times as we get an update on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Interesting, the president has kind of embraced that name for his plan, his program. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Jenna from West Philadelphia has to say. Jenna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm about to be self-employed, and I'm looking at health insurance options. And I haven't seen premiums lower than $250 a month, and that's for basic care. And I would like to know how these government subsidies under the Affordable Care Act will help me for monthly premiums and when I can expect them to be available.
Can you take that, David Grandy?
Sure. Thank you. We're going to have this quote-unquote open enrollment period from October 1st to December 31st where these marketplaces are supposed to come online. And at that point, people can go online and see, you know, depending what state they live in, so there'll be one here in Pennsylvania that the federal government sets up, see what the options are that are available to them. At the same time, they'll be able to enter in their income through the website and then figure out what kind of financial assistance they can get depending on, you know, how much money they earn. People who earn up to 400% of the federal poverty level, which for a family of four is around $90,000, will be eligible for some assistance. And the way that it's calculated how much support you will get from the federal government is a percent of your income.
Oh, wow.
That essentially of how much you would have to pay for insurance is a percent of the premium that you would have to pay. And then the federal government essentially backfills the rest of that money in. And that percent of your income that you have to pay goes up as you make more money.
Anything you want to add to that? I'm thinking people that are self-employed, oftentimes their income is, you know, up one year, down another year. I don't, you know, is that factored in?
That will be a challenge in the implementations, is people's income fluctuates over the year even. And so kind of determining what the right income is at that when you sign up can be a challenge. Folks like the callers who the ACA is really in targeting.
Yes.
It's people want to start their own business that are self-employed who don't have another mechanism to access health insurance except through the marketplace. And the ACA is intended to make that marketplace work better and also to provide some subsidies.
Jenna, thanks for the call. Let's see what Martha from Washington Square West has to say. Martha, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having this show, first of all. I think there's a lot of education that needs to be done about the ACA. My question has to do specifically with what is going on in Pennsylvania in terms of the establishment of the federal government's participation and establishment of these exchanges. And since we do have, I think, a fairly hostile administration in Harrisburg, are they cooperating? Are they delaying? What's specifically going on in Pennsylvania?
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm looking at both of you, and we're all pointing at you, David Grandy. Go ahead.
Well, Pennsylvania is interesting because, of course, we have a governor who's been pretty opposed to the Affordable Care Act. He signed on to the lawsuit early on that challenged the Affordable Care Act. At the same time, the state has voted very blue in many of our presidential elections. So we're a very interesting kind of bellwether state, I think, for the Affordable Care Act. And I think, first of all, to the caller's question, the federal government is going to set up one of these exchanges or marketplaces in Pennsylvania. We haven't seen yet what that will look like. We haven't seen the rate filings for Pennsylvania yet. But the other key provision, of course, is whether or not the state of Pennsylvania expands the Medicaid program. And there, our legislature just adjourned at the end of June, early July, wrapping up the budget, and the Senate actually had passed a provision to expand our Medicaid program and to push the governor to do that, and that's the Republican-controlled Senate. The state House, also Republican-controlled, was against that, and so it got pulled from the state budget, and it's all up in the air right now. And so, I think that there's some state senators, both Republicans and Democrats, who are going to try to push this when the legislature reconvenes in September. But it's really up in the air, and supposedly our governor's been in some negotiations with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but it's been hard to get concrete information about where that stands.
And Bob, would it be fair to say that if the federal government is setting up these exchanges, it's going to be different for every state, so that what they do in Pennsylvania might be different from what they would do in Texas, for instance?
Some parts may be different. Right. They'll try to tailor the exchanges to the individual states, insofar as their insurance regulations is different in different states, and they'll try to incorporate that in the design of the exchanges. But broadly, I think the federal exchanges will look pretty similar across the states.
And will this, I mean, perhaps in 10, maybe 20, maybe 50 years, I mean, is this designed in part to control costs? Because as we know, every year the cost of health care goes up in this country. It's dramatically more expensive to get health care in this country than any other industrialized country. Do you want to take that, Bob?
There are some components of the Affordable Care Act that address the cost issue, but that is not, I think, the primary purpose of the Affordable Care Act, and it shouldn't be the metric by which it's judged. The Affordable Care Act primarily is about expanding health insurance coverage. Now, I think, like Massachusetts, which passed a similar law and implemented in 2006, they're now struggling with costs and the increase in costs recently, and they're now trying to find a way to rein those costs in. And I suspect we'll be addressing that issue on a federal basis probably in the next couple of years.
I mean, is there something about our system or perhaps even us, the people, that makes us have such an expensive system?
Well, our prices are high in this country compared to other countries. I think there's a myth out there that the reason that healthcare is so expensive in the United States is that we just use so much more of it than other countries. And certainly there are certain kinds of health services that we do use a lot more of in this country. But, you know, at the end of the day, we pay much higher prices. And partly why we pay much higher prices is a lot of other countries leverage their government as a central purchaser or as a regulator in some way to either regulate prices or have the government directly negotiate those prices. And I don't see us moving in that direction anytime soon. So it's hard, you know, to figure out how you can restructure things. And we tend to focus on utilization in this country as a way to try to deal with spending.
But it is interesting that some of the critics of this Affordable Care Act say this is government-controlled insurance, that it's the government taking over the insurance of...
Yeah, so the Affordable Care Act very much tries to preserve private health insurance as, you know, a main form of covering people in the United States. You know, the Medicaid expansion is an increase in, you know, government-provided insurance, but overall I think that, you know, the Affordable Care Act could be a stabilizing force in terms of the reliance on private health insurance in this country. We were seeing private health insurance rates gradually decline over time, and I think this is going to actually increase the use of private insurance in the United States.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, getting an update on the Affordable Care Act with our guests, Robert Towne and David Grandy, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. It is a complicated system, an expensive system, and the Affordable Care Act is designed to try to address some of these issues. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A lot of dads dream of watching even one of their kids make it to the NFL, but Gordy Gronkowski saw three of his sons get there, including New England Patriots superstar Rob Gronkowski. Gordy and the boys talk about how they did it in the new memoir, Growing Up Gronk. Gordy joins us next time on Tell Me More.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Kirkpatrick, New York Times Cairo bureau chief. He arrived in the region just before the start of the Arab Spring, covered the Egyptian Revolution, and now he's been reporting on the military's ouster of Egypt's first democratically elected president. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Thank you.
Most parents hate to think about their teens and young adult children using and misusing alcohol. Experimentation is common, but it comes with risks to health and safety at an important time of physical and emotional development. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, the birds and the bees of young adult drinking, what parents and their children need to know and talk about. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Again, talking with Robert Town and David Grandy about the Affordable Care Act, passed into law more than 3 years ago, last June, a year ago, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act, but the U.S. House of Representatives, I think, has voted about 40 times or nearly 40 times to, if not undo it, undo portions of it. It has been implemented over the last couple of years with a couple of deadlines coming up later on this year. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Gary from Malvern to join us on Radio Times. Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I've heard this statement before, that it's going to be the immortal young that will subsidize, you know, they're healthy and all so forth, and subsidize the sickly old or whatever. That's not how I always looked at the health insurance. I've had it since I was in my 20s. It's bankruptcy insurance, and I can tell you for a fact that I have been many times blessed that I've had it, even though I haven't used a lot of it. But when it happened, when things happened, it was very costly. And I don't know if young people know just how costly it can be and how at risk they are. You can have a car accident. All of a sudden, you're on ice, and suddenly you're in a hospital. You can have, look at the obesity that's increasing now and type 2 diabetes among the young. This should not be considered something like the healthy young versus the unhealthy old.
Well, Gary, let me take your point, and there's a reason they're called the invincibles, because they think they are invincible. Do you want to take that, Bob?
You know, Gary's right that the primary purpose of insurance is to protect against risk and to protect against bankruptcy if you, in fact, have a serious injury. That being said, I think the way the premiums are structured under the ACA, that for many of the young males, they might not be a good deal. And so that's a concern.
Because it'll be expensive?
Because it'll be relatively expensive relative to their likelihood of having a serious problem. So that's the concern, is that you have to nudge young males and young females into purchasing health insurance where it might not be in their best interest, and hopefully the premiums, right, subsidies will be sufficient to nudge them in that way, but we'll see.
Well, it's more a psychological issue, isn't it, as much as it is an economic one?
Yeah, so, you know, again, you know, this term invincible is used for a reason. I think it's hard to get young people to think about risk in all aspects of life, not just in healthcare. You know, but I think that, you know, giving them financial help to try to bring them into the market. And I think the individual mandate, hopefully increasing people's sense that they should have insurance and that it's a good idea, I think is exactly what we need to do, because there are so many uncertainties, I think, in health and healthcare, and it's impossible to predict, you know, when you're going to have a catastrophic, you know, incident or when you're going to come down with a significant illness. And I think people need financial protection mm-hmm. against those things. And I think the idea of the Affordable Care Act is to get people into the system early and have them insured over their entire life.
I mean, car insurance, is a car insurance a good sort of model to think about? Which is, if you have a car, you're required to get insurance?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the pushback against the car insurance thing has been that some people say, well, I don't have to own a car, and therefore I don't have to have insurance. But I think the key thing here is, well, you're here in our country. You are part of us and our healthcare system. If you get ill, you know, we will see you in an American hospital. And so to the extent that that's like owning a car, I think they're very analogous to one another.
Does it work for you?
Absolutely. I mean, the analogy here is that if you don't have car insurance and you get in a wreck and you don't have money to pay, then you kind of get to walk away and don't accept responsibility. Here, by having health insurance, you're taking financial responsibility in case you get ill.
Right. But the idea is that if you don't have insurance and you need to use the system, someone else is going to pay your bills. I mean, that's just business, right?
Absolutely. That if you go to the ER because you have you broke your foot, and you don't have the resources to pay, then the hospital will end up picking up the bill, and that ultimately gets kind of spread throughout the system because the hospital needs to cover its costs.
And is one of the goals is to get people to stop thinking of the ER as the doctor's office?
Yeah, I think I think ideally we will have, as part of the Affordable Care Act, a primary care system that is more robust, that people come to rely on more, people have good access to. That's not a new problem in American healthcare. We've been having this conversation for decades now about how to improve our, system of primary care and outpatient care. And hopefully this will provide some motivation to move those conversations along. Certainly, there's a lot of concerns that as people get insurance, that there'll be more demand on that system as well, and could at least temporarily stress that system. But these are not new problems in terms of thinking about how to get the American healthcare system more focused on efficient, high-value care that is high quality, that focuses on prevention.
Let me see what Russell from Downingtown has to say. Russell, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. The question I was asking is about this 30-hour work week rule.
Right.
I have several people that are working with me who are part-time, quote-unquote, and we do get incredible benefits where I work. I don't want to get into the employer. But a lot of these people are now having their hours cut significantly from 40 hours a week down to 29 in order to comply with the law. Otherwise, they would be considered full-time employees, which changes the whole cost structure for the employers. And we're seeing a lot of people from other prominent companies doing the same, employers doing the same, coming to us for employment and whatever. So, and also, I'd like to know how you think all these young people are going to not just do the buyout. In other words, they don't have the money to buy insurance, so why not just pay the $95 or $100, whatever the penalty is going to be to the government, and still not have insurance. So there's sort of two questions.
No, they're two good questions, Russell. Thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. Do you want to take the first one, which is companies responding to some of these requirements?
Yeah, well, so now they don't have to respond to these requirements because they're not going to be enforced until next year. So they have at least a year reprieve before they have to think about their employment structure. But there's no doubt that within the ACA and this employer mandate has embedded in it the incentives to reduce employment down to below 30 hours per week. So that's one of the concerns about the law.
Right.
And something I think they would like to revisit in order to address. And on the second question about the penalty, which is a $95 the first year, and that's a pretty modest penalty compared to the cost of health insurance. But that penalty goes up over time, and it will reach about $695 over the next couple of years, which is a little bit more of a bite, mm-hmm. Particularly for not getting health insurance and getting nothing for that $695,000. And the other hope is that because it is the law of the land, that people will kind of respond to that and think of it as their civic duty to sign up for health insurance.
Go ahead, Dave.
Well, and I think in Massachusetts it was very similar in that the penalty for individuals for not signing up was very modest there, and yet you saw very robust participation. I think it speaks to what Bob was saying, is people do not want to spend money and get nothing. And there's also, so I think there's just this very powerful sense behind the individual mandate that no one wants to lose money. And so even though the penalties are modest, they seem to be very effective mm-hmm. in Massachusetts.
And I realize the employer part, we're talking about a small percentage of people working at companies that are more than 50 that provide insurance. But I could see how a company would want to perhaps play with some of these numbers for their own bottom line.
Yeah, of course. And so I think, anytime you have to set up a set of rules and come up with cutoffs, you start to distort the market in some way. And I think this is an example where you have this kind of threshold right at 30 hours that people are trying to get below or stay above, depending on their situation. And how exactly, the administration should try to revise this, they're probably going to be constrained to some extent by the way the legislation was written. And perhaps, a year or 6 months into implementation, there will be the opportunity for some meaningful legislative changes. But right now, you can't really open this can of worms in the Congress because the Congress is just incapable of having a rational conversation about the Affordable Care Act right now.
Let me see what Steve from Queen Village has to say. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve. Go ahead.
I have employer-provided health care insurance. It's really a very good plan. You know, the PPO, I go to whoever I want. I don't need any referrals, whatever specialist I want to go to. $15 copay, and I'm wondering what effect is the ACA going to have on that type of coverage? Is it going to be like priced so high that employers will no longer choose it? How is it going to impact people like myself?
Fair enough. Steve, thanks for the call. I'm tossing that to you, Bob.
So in the short run, nothing is going to happen. The ACA won't affect you. In the long run, it may affect you, and there's a tax that for very generous health plans will start to be a tax, which could increase the cost of a very generous plan.
And how far down the road is that tax?
I believe it gets implemented in 2017,
18. Right. Because it's a benefit, right? I mean, that's the idea of taxing it, because this is a benefit that people are getting?
Health insurance is a benefit that you get that's kind of not taxable.
Right.
So it kind of has this inherent subsidy. So now the ACA kind of layers a tax to kind of counteract that lack of tax responsibility of the insurance. And so it's a little bit of a kind of a pushing in two different directions at the same time.
You see that?
Yeah, there's most Americans don't realize there's a massive subsidy for employer-sponsored insurance in this country. It's several $100 billion a year that is expended to support this system. And so I think that, people think of their health insurance somehow differently than the other compensation they get. But as an employer, at the end of the day, they're thinking about the total compensation to hire a worker. And health insurance is a part of that. And right now, we exempt those health benefits from taxation, even though they're part of your compensation. I think, as Bob pointed out earlier in the show, I think economists would like to have that all just be part of your compensation and be taxable and think about health insurance differently. But I think that it's difficult to think about doing that. And so we set up this special tax to roll out in 2017 that will just kick in for people who have very generous plans.
But, I mean, what you're saying is that the system is sort of unfairly structured, which is if you get health insurance through your employer, you are getting this subsidy, this benefit that other people are not getting.
Yeah, exactly. So, if you are a high-wage worker, you are getting a very large subsidy compared to someone who is not getting their health insurance through the workplace and having to go buy it on their own. Whatever marginal tax rate you're paying in the income tax system, that's how much benefit you're getting.
Steve, thanks for the call. Let's see what Kayla from Berwyn has to say. Kayla, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
For this program. It's great. Okay. Question. I am self-employed, have been for years, and I've been basically paying for my health insurance from my savings because I don't make enough, and my premiums are like $730 a month.
Wow.
So I pay for my health insurance from my savings, basically in order to protect my savings in case I get hit with some bad health issue. My question is, I will probably qualify for some type of subsidy, and so I'll be paying less in premiums. Right now, the premiums I pay reduce my taxable income. Is the premium I will still pay, is that still a full reduction of my taxable income to get to my adjusted gross income?
We have some. We're doing some mental math here on the radio, Kayla. That's probably a question you should put to your tax person, just to specifically answer that part of your question. But it is interesting. She's paying a lot, David. She's paying a lot in monthly insurance premiums.
Yeah, and again, as we mentioned earlier, this sounds like someone who the ACA is made for in some ways, a self-employed individual. And so my guess is, it's hard to know individual circumstances, but two things will likely happen. One is that premium will be lower if purchased in the health insurance marketplaces or exchanges. We're seeing for these bronze silver plans in some states that have announced rates that are more in the $380 range per month. And so it's hard to know, again, with exact circumstances. But then having some subsidies kick in as well, depending on how much income the caller earns, will potentially lower that. So I would be surprised if the caller wasn't much better off when going into the exchanges when they get up and running.
And we had mentioned Massachusetts, Bob, but it looks like many people are choosing the bronze premium versus the gold premium. I'm not sure what that tells us, but I think it's interesting.
It is interesting. This is research my colleague Amanda Stark has done, and she's found that the vast majority of folks in Massachusetts who are purchasing health insurance through the exchange are enrolling in the bronze plans, which are the relatively less generous plans. People are very premium sensitive.
Yeah.
And then in some sense, that's good because that's going to kind of inject some more competitive pressure into the insurance marketplace. And so that's interesting development.
Looking ahead, let's say 5 years or so, do we have enough healthcare people to get this system up and running?
So, you know, that's a complex question because sometimes it gets down to what kind of healthcare people. So I think that in general, we need to figure out how to provide more primary care. That's probably through some more primary care doctors, but that's also probably through other providers like nurse practitioners and physician assistants becoming a more robust part of the primary care team. And then I think that there's probably other types of workers that we have very few of that we probably need a lot more of. So, for example, if you're in, trying to think about in the future managing populations in your primary care practice, you need to be a little more savvy with navigating IT systems, for example.
Oh, interesting. So frontline medical people and IT, something to think about. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. David Grandy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Robert Towne, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.